Okay, so today is August 22nd, 2015. Okay, we'll begin with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so we are continuing with the discussion of sutta number 137 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Salayatana Vibhanga Sutta. Analysis of the sixfold base for the six sense bases. As I pointed out last time, the sixfold base of the six sense bases is really just like the starting point for the discourse. But as the Buddha develops the discourse, he moves into other topics, which are all sort of evolving out from the six sense bases, but leading to like higher and higher stages of realization or attainment. So last time we went over the six internal sense bases, which are the six sense faculties: the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body and mind. The six external sense bases, the corresponding objects, the six classes of consciousness, and the six classes of contact, the contact of the mind or consciousness with the object through a sense faculty, then the 18 kinds of mental exploration, and the 36, what are called the 36 positions of beings. Did I do this? Did I complete the 36 positions of beings? Yes.
We're up to paragraph. You started paragraph 12.
Okay. Brief. I know that I. Yeah. Now I see that I did paragraph 13 also. I think I didn't do paragraph 14. And so we'll resume at paragraph 14. So the 36, what are called the 36 positions of beings, just to recapitulate, and you find them sort of laid out schematically on the handout, that we have six kinds of joy based on the household life, and this is briefly summed up as the joy at gaining forms, the six sense objects: forms, sounds, odors, tastes, tactile objects, mental objects. Then six kinds of joy based on renunciation. This is the joy that arises along with insight into the impermanence of the six kinds of sense objects. Then there are six kinds of sadness based on the household life. That is sadness at not gaining the objects of desire, not gaining forms and so on, And then six kinds of sadness based on renunciation. And that is a little bit, you know, initially it's a little bit perplexing, but basically it is when one has insight into the impermanence of the sense objects, but one is not able to reach any kind of higher attainment, then one has this sadness or displeasure at the thought, when shall I enter and dwell in that base that the noble ones enter and dwell in? And so one has a longing for what is called the supreme liberations, and then grief or sadness arises based on that longing. Okay, so then this applies to form, sounds, odors, and so on. So we get six kinds of sadness based on renunciation. Okay, then we come to the new section. This is six kinds of equanimity based on the household life. And as I explained last week, this distinction of household life and renunciation does it sort of not necessarily tie down to those who are householders and those who are monastics, but it's rather the attitude or the orientation that is the key distinction. Whether one is being oriented towards, you know, towards grasping and clinging, in which case it's called something that pertains or based on the household life, and if one is inclined towards relinquishment, giving up attachment, then it is based on renunciation. Okay, so now we come to the six kinds of equanimity based on the household life. And the word for equanimity here is upeka. Usually we think of upeka in Buddhism as being always a positive virtue. But here a distinction is made between upeka as a positive virtue and also upeka as, call it a fault, a defect, a liability. So the six kinds of equanimity based on the household life would be upeka as a defect or a liability. So this is the case, first we'll take the actual text of the sutta. On seeing a form with the eye, equanimity arises in a foolish, infatuated, ordinary person. The word rendered here, ordinary person, this is puttujana, which is also rendered a worldling, or a common person. And this is also described as the untaught, uninstructed, worldly person who has not conquered his limitations or conquered the results of his karma. I have to say it's a rather peculiar phrase, and who is blind to the danger. So I would describe this as what we might call dull indifference, the kind of neutrality of the attitude of maybe apathy or complacency of not caring one way or another. And so it's said that such equanimity as this does not transcend the form. That is why it is called equanimity based on the household life. Yeah, the commentary explains this as the equanimity of unknowing, of lack of knowledge. And if you know, if you're familiar with the Abhidhamma teaching of different states of consciousness, different cittas, this would probably be the equanimity which is present in some of the akusala cittas, the unwholesome states of consciousness. Particularly it's the equanimity that's present in Four of the unwholesome cittas rooted in greed, in the citta connected with doubt, in the citta connected with restlessness. Correct? Okay, so the simplest way to understand this is, I use the phrase dull indifference, worldly apathy, or as the commentary explains it, the equanimity which is based on unknowing or ignorance. Okay, then we have the six kinds of equanimity based on renunciation. Then these are explained as the types of equanimity that arise as a result of insight knowledge. So when one knows the impermanence, change, cessation of forms, one sees as it actually is with proper wisdom that forms both in the past and now are impermanent, bound up with dukkha, with suffering, and subject to change. So in that case, equanimity arises, and such it's said that this equanimity transcends the form. That is, it rises above attachment to the form. Whereas the equanimity is connected with the worldly equanimity doesn't transcend the form in that it can still be tied up or bound to attachment to the form. Okay, then the same applies when knowing the impermanence of sounds, odors, tastes, tactile objects, mental objects. Basically the same elaboration. Okay, so that takes us through the 36, what are called the 36 satapada position, translated here positions of beings or states of beings. Maybe states of beings is better. Okay, any questions at this point on the 36?
Equanimity based on the household life, that's not really equanimity, is it? It's more indifference than...
Well, I would prefer the word indifference, actually, but in Pali it turns out to be the same word, upeka. When we use, when we render this in English, I mean, to be consistent, we render it as equanimity. But when we think of it as a negative or unwholesome quality, sort of equanimity doesn't quite ring a bell. So you could call it indifference, dull apathy. Okay, I don't see any other hands, so we'll continue. Okay, so the exposition of the 36 positions of beings sort of lays the foundation for what is going to come next. And this is the teaching which is directed towards what I would call the process of transcendence, of overcoming what is inferior or lesser in order to arrive at what is superior, at a successively higher state. And as we'll see, that the Buddha has laid this out in a kind of schematic way, almost as though one is climbing a ladder, going from lower steps on the ladder to successively higher steps on the ladder. Okay, and so the process of transcendence is summarized in a little statement or a little formula, which is by depending on this, abandon that. And so this, even this brief statement of the process of transcendence shows that there are two factors involved. One is, he called this, the aim of the process of transcendence, and that is to abandon what is lesser or inferior. But if you just say, abandon this, then one is left without a method. And so then the Buddha gives the method with the other phrase, which here comes first, depending on this. So by relying on something which is superior, then one is able to abandon what is inferior. Again, to use the simile of a ladder, let us say it's a really long ladder, sort of leaning against the building. Then when one is climbing the ladder, one doesn't simply use your feet to go from one rung of the ladder to the next rung of the ladder, but one holds with one's hands, one holds on to either the rails of the ladder or to the higher rungs so that one is secure and doesn't stumble and fall off the ladder. And so one depends on the higher things, in this case, in order to abandon, to give up the lower things. Okay, so let's see how the Buddha lays this out. So he says, here, by depending and relying on the six kinds of joy based on renunciation, abandon and overcome the six kinds of joy based on the household life. It is thus that they are abandoned. It is thus that they are, in Yanomami, used surmounted, but maybe I would prefer transcended or overcome. Okay, by depending and relying on the six kinds of grief or displeasure or sadness based on renunciation, abandon and overcome the six kinds of sadness based on the household life. It is thus they are abandoned, thus they are overcome. By depending and relying on the six kinds of equanimity based on renunciation, abandon and overcome the six kinds of equanimity based on the household life. It is thus they are abandoned, thus they are overcome. Okay, so this is laid out, you could see, in a pattern of pairing six kinds of joy with six kinds of joy, six kinds of sadness with six kinds of sadness, six kinds of equanimity with six kinds of equanimity. And what is probably of these the most difficult to overcome? Which do you think is the most difficult to overcome? Maybe I make it a test. Excuse me? Equanimity? Anybody else have any opinion about that? What is it that craving really yearns for and attaches itself to? Is it equanimity?
It's joy.
Yeah, joy, pleasure, delight.
It would be awesome if we were attached to equanimity.
Excuse me?
It would be good if we were kind of attached to
equanimity. I mean, there's a subtle kind of equanimity which can, or indifference, which can generate its own kind of attachment. But the most obvious base of attachment is joy.
I have to say from my life's work that it would depend on what kind of a person you were.
Maybe
if you were
so.
A really depressed person, you'd be clinging to sadness. And overcoming that, you would transcend.
I'm not so sure. I mean, I think that there is a certain personal variation, but I think depressed people would like to be happy, which is why they would go to, to see psychologists or psychotherapist in order to move from sadness to some kind of happiness. That's my opinion. Okay, so how does one renounce the joy based on the household life? The sutta doesn't actually explain in a methodical way how one does that, but the Buddha does give various methods in other suttas of developing, call this the mind of renunciation. The mind is ready to give up the joy or pleasure based on the household life. We get sort of the concise expression of this in what is called the progressive discourse of the Buddha, for example. We find this in Sutta number 56. Yeah, and this is page 485. Okay, when the Buddha is giving a progressive instruction to the householder of Pali, he explains the danger, degradation, or we can say the vanity and defilement in sensual pleasures, and the blessing of renunciation. Okay, so one way to give, or at least one approach to giving up the joy based on the household life, is to see into, we might call this the danger, the adinava, the drawback, and the defilement of sensual pleasures or pleasures based on the worldly life. And what is the danger or drawback in pleasures based on the worldly life? At least from one angle.
The joy does not last forever.
Okay, in one word, summarize.
Impermanent.
It's impermanent, yeah. Also, it's in some way, at some level, bound up with dukkha, with unsatisfactoriness, displeasure, suffering. And we could see fuller expositions of the drawback and sensual pleasures. You look at Sutta number 13 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Sutta number 75 actually is the most powerful. This is like on page 611, where the Buddha compares the joys or pleasures of sensual indulgence to that of a man with a skin disease. Here it's given as leprosy, but maybe it's some other disease. But he gets his pleasure from scratching his wounds. And when he's scratching the wounds, he thinks this is pleasant, it's really enjoyable. But when he gets cured of his illness, then he realizes that having that skin disease was really painful and miserable from the start, and that the pleasure that he got from scratching the wounds was just a very low and vile kind of pleasure. And so if they give him a choice, would you like to have that skin disease again in order to get the pleasure from scratching your wounds? He's saying, no, I would be much more satisfied to be cured of the illness. Okay, and then comes sort of a counterpoint to the joy of the household life is the joy of renunciation. So this would be the freedom that, initially at least, the freedom that comes from being tied and bound up to sensual enjoyment. And then as one proceeds further, particularly with bhavana with meditation, there would come the joy of overcoming the five mental hindrances, the joy and pleasure of the jhanic attainments, and then what's mentioned in this sutta, the joy of insight, of gaining insight into the impermanence of all objects of the senses. And so using the framework of, or the method of this sutta, by depending on the joy that comes from insight into impermanence, one gives up the joy that comes from indulgence in the pleasures of the sense objects. Okay, then next, this is a little more difficult. By depending and relying on the six kinds of, let's say, sadness or displeasure, based on renunciation, abandon and overcome the six kinds of sadness based on the household life. I'm trying to think whether people actually use this approach, or whether it's just included here for the sake of consistency with the method of exposition. Can anybody think of particular cases where one might use the sadness based on renunciation to overcome the sadness based on the household life? Seems to me more likely that to overcome the sadness or displeasure based on the household life, one would move into sort of seeking the joy based on renunciation. And so one would get a certain joy that comes from insight into the impermanence of the six sense objects. But then, when one fails to proceed further and to reach what the text calls the supreme liberations that the noble ones enter on, then that sadness would arise, or that displeasure. Yes, Christopher, please take the microphone.
I think sometimes you have some kind of personal, like, existential crisis.
Yeah.
You can have some hint of the knowledge. You can have some hint of the knowledge that everything is impermanent, you know, the universe is so vast. Mm. What am I? Okay. And that's kind of a grief based on renunciation, I feel like, which leads you away from worldly distractions, watching TV,
stuff like that. Yeah, that's a possibility. Anybody else have anything? Yeah, take the microphone.
In the previous paragraphs, when it said about the monks seeing, when shall I act upon abiding that? When you see how hard it is to get to those things, you see how our joy in the worldly life leads us further away, and that kind of creates more grief, I think, in that by depending on relying on six kinds of grief, you're seeing that you don't see that as joy anymore, you see that as grief. And that grief, I think, is contributing to more grief because you're seeing how it's leading you away from where you want to go. When we see, when we try to walk the path, I start to see how the worldly life leads you further away.
Yeah.
It's not joy anymore. You're seeing it as I see it as grief, because what starts out as joy always ends in pain.
So you're seeing that the joy of the worldly life is really bound up with suffering and leads to more suffering.
Exactly.
Yeah. But that's the point that, well, that I made earlier in regard to giving up the six kinds of joy based on the worldly life through seeing the, on the one hand, the impermanence or the unsatisfactory nature of those joys. But this is using the sadness or abandoning the sadness based on the worldly life, based on six kinds of sadness based on renunciation. One gives up the six kinds of sadness based on the worldly life. In most instances, I find that a little difficult to see. Yes, please. Please take the microphone that will be handed back.
I'm not sure if this is directly related, but sometimes when I'm focused on suffering of a worldly nature, or the oh woe is me nature, I can think about beings that are struggling simply to live.
You think about
how much the beings that are just struggling to live, how much suffering.
Yeah.
We experience collectively about how far we are from liberation, and that's where the transfer my own worldly sadness to a sadness that's maybe a little bit not to see it category because it's looking at suffering collectively.
Okay, possible. Okay, let's go on anyway. So now we come to by depending and relying on the six kinds of equanimity based on renunciation, abandon and overcome the six kinds of equanimity based on the household life. Okay, again. I don't know, I don't want to seem like a little too rebellious. But again, it seems to me that sort of the more direct way is to overcome, call this the six kinds of worldly apathy or indifference. It seems to me that one normally moves by from that worldly apathy or indifference to the joy of renunciation. And maybe then from that joy of renunciation, then one comes, cools that off to get to the equanimity based on renunciation. But that is sort of anticipating what's coming in the next section. Can we think of cases of proceeding directly from the equanimity based on the household life to the equanimity based on renunciation? Maybe somebody with very sharp insight who starts off as, you know, let's say, a worldly person immersed in this dull apathy and indifference. Then he learns about the Dhamma, starts practicing insight meditation. But normally, even in the sequence of insight meditation, one goes through stages of exhilarating joy and piti and sukha before it sort of cools off and gets to equanimity. But maybe because he's making that equanimity his aim, so he remains fairly indifferent to the joy and rapture that arise, and then moves into the equanimity based on renunciation. Take the microphone.
I would think that once you experience joy based on the worldly life, you become jaded after a while and indifferent to things.
And yeah.
It no longer stimulates you.
Yeah.
And just you have as much of access to all these worldly stimulations as you could wish for.
Yeah.
Where do you go from there?
Yeah.
So you become different to it all.
Actually, that's a good idea. That here, well, in this case, when it's not so much going from equanimity based on the household life to equanimity based on renunciation, but when it's going from the joys based on the household life, you know, the pleasures, well, maybe through understanding their impermanence, their unsatisfactoriness, then one becomes indifferent to them with a healthy kind of indifference, and then one moves into the insight that leads to equanimity.
But also, the Buddha mentions that
the Buddha mentions that renunciation is supported by insight. It's not just somebody who's into it, it's somebody who's insightful and looking at it.
Yeah, well, I said that. This is the insight based on, or equanimity based on insight.
Right.
In any case, it seems that the scheme that we have laid out in this paragraph here about depending on this, abandon that, it's a little bit of an oversimplification, I would say, for the ease of exposition. But actually, there are all sorts of more complex routes that people can take, depending upon their past experience, their dispositions, and just, you know, their way of evaluating and treating their experience. Okay, but now with the next paragraph, and here in the sheet that I handed out, I have this laid out in section on the process of transcendence, section B. I call this the refinement of feelings based on renunciation. And so now we're taking just the feelings or the experiences that arise on the side of renunciation, or the side of spiritual cultivation, and moving from what are considered the grosser states to the more elevated states. Okay, and so here, by depending on the six kinds of joy based on renunciation, abandon and overcome the six kinds of grief, sadness, displeasure, based on renunciation. It is thus they are abandoned, it is thus they overcome. Okay, so we take the case of a person who is gaining insight into the impermanence, change, and fading away of forms and the other objects. Then this longing for the supreme liberation arises, and then because of that longing, displeasure arises conditioned by that longing. Okay, so now to overcome that displeasure, one relies on the six kinds of joy based on renunciation. So suppose the person hasn't yet reached those states of supreme liberation, but still, okay, I'm just putting myself in that position, this longing is arising, one is feeling sad, maybe discouraged, despondent. And so there are ways to reflect that will overcome, help one to overcome that discouragement, that sense of despondency, and to generate joy based on renunciation. So like one of the methods that the text will recommend, that the text do recommend, is recollection of the Buddha. This is a meditation subject that naturally generates joy and happiness. So when one is feeling despondent and discouraged, then one can reflect on the Buddha, the qualities of the Buddha. And so one takes, the way I would explain it is, you know, the text enumerate 9 qualities of the Buddha. But to make it simple, I take 3 qualities. Arahant, the worthy one or the holy one, Sama Sambuddho, the perfectly enlightened one, and Bhagava, translated the blessed one, but the Bhagava is really the fortunate one, the one who possesses all excellent qualities. And so when one turns the mind towards the recollection of the Buddha, then there arises a feeling of joy, bliss, delight, even ecstasy. Similarly, one can do the recollection of the Dhamma, qualities of the Dhamma, that one has gained access to this well-expounded Dhamma, which is directly visible, inviting investigation, and so on. And recollection of the Sangha. One could call to mind the community of, say, the enlightened monks and nuns, and recollect their qualities, their noble qualities, and then rejoice in that. And so, instead of being discouraged and despondent in this way, one could bring up joy and happiness. Another meditation object that brings up joy and happiness are the Brahma Viharas, especially loving kindness, or altruistic joy, mudita. Keep away from karuna, compassion, because then you have to focus on the suffering of others. And if one is feeling inwardly miserable or depressed or dejected oneself, then if one focuses on the suffering of others, it can pull one down. But by either extending loving kindness, the wish for the well-being and happiness of others, or by rejoicing in the good qualities of others, then it will uplift the mind. And then when the mind is uplifted, then one could turn to insight into the impermanence of form, sounds, odors, and so on. And in this way, one uses six kinds of joy based on renunciation to overcome six kinds of sadness based on renunciation. Okay, but even the joy based on renunciation, the joy that comes from either deep samadhi or the joy that arises through insight, underlying that joy there can be a subtle attachment, a subtle clinging. In fact, this is even, one could say that this is almost the more dangerous. No, I don't want to put it this way. But this could be a subtle clinging that keeps one bound to at least to lower states of realization and keeps one within the cycle of birth and death. And so to reach full liberation, one has to overcome even that subtle clinging to states of joy, bliss, and rapture. And so this is to be done by replacing the feeling of joy with the feeling of equanimity. And so the Buddha says, by depending on the six kinds of equanimity based on renunciation, abandon and surmount the six kinds of joy based on renunciation. Thus they are abandoned. Thus they are abandoned, abandoned. Thus they are.
Just abandoned.
Yeah.
No joy.
By relying on insight into the impermanence of sounds, abandon the joy that arises based on sounds. I think maybe the battery. No, it's come back.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's not back. Okay, I think that. No. Perhaps the batteries of this.
This one is dead.
That one died.
The red light's on.
Then why did this one die also? Anyway, let us continue. Okay, I have sound. Okay, so when based on the six kinds of equanimity, based on renunciation, one overcomes the six kinds of joy based on renunciation. And I think this can be understood both from the standpoint of samadhi and from the standpoint of insight, vipassana. From the standpoint of samadhi, one could understand that after entering the first and second and third jhanas, which are accompanied by somanasa, by the feeling of joy or pleasure, one progresses to the fourth jhana, which is accompanied by neutral feeling or equanimity. And then from the standpoint of insight, in the early stages of insight, the experience of insight is accompanied by joy, delight, even bliss as one is gaining insight into the impermanence of things. But as one progresses further, then that feeling of joy subsides and is replaced by the feeling of equanimity. Don't worry about it, Johnny. We can just pass. People can just speak loudly when they have questions. Okay, any questions at this point in the exposition? Okay, so now we pass on to the next section. And now the Buddha is going to be speaking about taking equanimity as the topic or theme, and then explaining how equanimity is successively refined. So he speaks about equanimity that is diversified based on diversity. So what is that? He says there is equanimity regarding forms, sounds, odors, flavors, and tangibles or tactile objects. This is equanimity that is diversified based on diversity. So this is contrasting the equanimity which arises from sensory experience with now we're going to move to equanimity that's unified based on unity. And then to explain this, he says there is equanimity in regard to the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So this is the equanimity that is unified based on the unity. Okay, what is missing, not explicitly brought into this contrast, is the equanimity that's present in the jhanas, the jhanic attainments. So we have equanimity that is diversified, that is spread out amongst the five types of sense objects, and then equanimity that's unified. This is the equanimity that's present in the four arupa samapattis, the four formless meditative attainments. But what about the equanimity in the jhanas? Okay, that also, I would say, is equanimity that is based on unity. But the equanimity in the jhanas, so it's based on unity, because it's based on a single object, on the unification of the mind on the objects. But there is still, one could say, diversity amongst the objects of jhanas. So we could say that there's the jhana based on the earth kasina, the equanimity based on the water kasina, equanimity based on the blue kasina, red kasina, white kasina, yellow kasina, the jhana based on loving kindness, based on compassion, based on altruistic joy, based on equanimity towards people. So many different objects of jhana, even though the equanimity within the jhana is unified based on unity. And also the equanimity in the jhana, the four jhanas, though much more exalted than the equanimity based on sense pleasures, but it's still not yet fully purified. But when you looking for the fully unified, fully purified equanimity, that is what one finds in the formless meditations. Going up to the peak of the equanimity based on the meditation of neither perception nor non-perception. The subtlest and most exalted meditative attainment on the side of samadhi. Okay, so the Buddha says, now he brings in the aspect of transcendence here. By depending and relying on equanimity that is unified, based on unity, abandon and overcome equanimity that is diversified, based on diversity. It is thus that this is abandoned, thus this is overcome. So this sets up again, it uses the polarity of the equanimity that's diversified, spread out among sense objects, and contrasting that with the equanimity based on the four formless meditations. But actually, to reach the equanimity of the formless meditations, we have to, you know, climb up a ladder with many, many rungs to it. You know, so we start with our ordinary, you know, day-to-day meditation. Then we're practicing at least for a certain amount of time. We might be able to discard, you know, the distraction of the mind by sensory objects and keep the mind focused, even if we can just unify the mind for a few moments on its object, whether it be mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of bodily sensations, mindfulness or meditation on loving kindness, recollection of the Buddha, or any other meditation object. We're able to, you know, overcome temporarily distraction by the five hindrances and keep the mind focused on a single object, even just for a few moments. Then we're getting a taste of that experience of equanimity based on unity, on unification of mind. Okay, as one progresses further, now, through intensive practice, then one enters the first jhana, which is accompanied by joy, but then one progresses to the second jhana, still accompanied by joy, third jhana, still accompanied by joy, then the fourth jhana, where joy gives way to indifferent feeling or equanimity. Then from the fourth jhana, then one can progress to the formless meditations in which that equanimity based on unity becomes even more purified, more, speak of unity becoming more unified. That sounds redundant. So let's say that the equanimity based on unity becomes increasingly more refined and more purified. Okay, but even underlying the equanimity of the formless meditations, including the equanimity that underlies, that accompanies the base of neither perception nor non-perception, even underlying that, there is a subtle clinging. And we see this contrast brought out in an interesting sutta, a very deep sutta, number 106. Okay, this is on page 872. Okay, the text says that the Buddha is speaking about the lower perceptions, and then he says, where these perceptions cease without remainder, that is the peaceful, that is the sublime or the excellent, namely the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, when he practices in this way and frequently abides thus, his mind acquires confidence in that base. Once there is full confidence, he either attains to the base of neither perception nor non-perception now, or else he resolves upon it with wisdom. Okay, on the dissolution of the body after death, it is possible that the evolving consciousness may pass on to the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So as long as there's a subtle clinging that underlies that experience of equanimity, the mind is not yet fully liberated. And then later on the same lower on the same page, the Buddha says, when the monk clings, he's clinging to the base of neither perception nor non-perception, he clings to the best object of clinging, for this is the best object of clinging, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, but then the Buddha goes on to explain how the monk practices in such a way that he attains that base. This is on page 873. Thus he obtains equanimity, but he does not delight in that equanimity, welcome it, or remain holding to it. And since he does not do so, his consciousness does not become dependent on it and does not cling to it. And the monk, without clinging, attains Nibbana. Okay, so even though one attains the base of neither perception nor non-perception, which has the most refined type of equanimity, one can either, if one doesn't see it with insight and understand it with insight, there'll still be a subtle clinging to it, and that clinging becomes a bond which keeps one tied even to rebirth into the base, the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, which is still a state within the cycle of birth and death. But when one overcomes that clinging, even to that subtlest equanimity, then the mind is liberated. And so the Buddha is going to explain this here using different terminology in the present sutta. He says, okay, paragraph 20. By depending and relying on equanimity, that is unified, based on unity, one abandons and overcomes equanimity that is diversified. Okay, then the next stage, next phase, by depending and relying on, here the Buddha uses the word uttamayata, abandon and overcome equanimity that is unified, based on unity. It is thus this is abandoned and overcome. Okay, we have this term, uttamayata. The word is actually created by stringing together a number of other words and particles. So first we have the negation, which just means non, same as the English word non. Then we have tongue, which means that. Then the word maya, which means made of or made by. And then the suffix ta, which turns it into an abstract noun, something like the ending in English, ness, N-E-S-S. Okay, so uttamayata means literally not, how to put this, not made of thisness, not made of thatness. The commentary explains it as the absence of craving, but I think that's too, I take that to be somewhat too simplistic. I see it, maybe I would call this a deeper meaning, that means not identifying, this way I interpret it, not identifying with, not taking oneself to consist in that. Not taking that to be I, mine, or myself. And so what this would mean, in effect, is that one who attains that equanimity of the base of neither perception nor non-perception, in order to liberate the mind from the subtle clinging to that equanimity, contemplates even that equanimity as being not mine, not I, not myself. So this is why I render uttamayata, non-identification, not taking to be I or mine. And so then the text says, by depending and relying on non-identification, abandon and overcome equanimity that is unified, based on unity. It is thus this is abandoned, thus that is overcome. And then the commentary again identifies that uttamayata as uses a technical expression comes within the scheme of the Visuddhimagga, is called insight leading to emergence. This is the insight that is a bridge between the earlier stages of insight and the attainment of the world-transcending path. So it's the insight that culminates in the attainment of the Lokuttara Magga, the world-transcending or liberating path. And so this would be a practitioner who, you know, there are different routes that different practitioners take. This would be a practitioner who is able to achieve the formless meditative attainments, then uses insight into the impermanence and the selfless nature of the formless meditations in order to reach the supramundane path. And so such a practitioner would probably easily achieve arahatship. Okay, any questions on this so far? Yes, Chris? Is the microphone working now?
It's working.
Okay.
Chris, I'm in hope.
But the word atamayata, could that be referring to something like conceptual proliferation? Like, instead of non-identification, like non-discrimination?
Non-discrimination.
Like, kind of, in the Zen tradition, there's kind of an emphasis on abandoning conceptual thinking.
I don't think it would be the abandoning of conceptual thinking as such, because conceptual thinking would have been abandoned within even the jhanas and the formless meditations. So here there is actually, one has emerged from the jhana, and one is actually, the way I see it, one is using a conceptual thinking as a mode of understanding the formless meditation and seeing it as being not mine, not I, not myself. That's my interpretation. You know, the expression itself, I have to say, is not, it's used in the text without explanation. And so it's almost a little bit like a riddle to figure out what does the word actually mean. So to get the meaning, one has to take it in the various contexts in which it's used.
It seems like at some point you have to just give up the notion of self entirely. So not even saying that something is not, it's just, or not myself. You just abandon this, even this notion of self, right?
Well, I think to abandon the notion of self, to actually eradicate it at the deepest level, one has to contemplate, at least this is the way laid out, I'm not giving my opinion, the way it's laid out in the suttas, is that one contemplates the various objects of contemplation as being either impermanent, suffering, not self, or as being not mine, not I, not myself. And when one uproots the idea of self, the idea of I and mine, then one doesn't have to use any contemplation of it as being not self. Any other questions? Okay, then let's go on to the last section of this sutta, which it's rather be a little surprising, because we always hear about four satipatthanas, four foundations of mindfulness. But here the Buddha is speaking of three foundations of mindfulness. But they're quite different from the four foundations of mindfulness. These are called the three foundations of mindfulness that the Noble One cultivates, cultivating which the Noble One, the Arya, the Buddha here is referring to himself, is a teacher fit to instruct a group. Okay, and now he's explaining what these three foundations of mindfulness are. So he says, compassionate, concerned with their welfare, the teacher, the word satta, always refers to the Buddha, teaches the Dhamma to his disciples out of compassion, saying, this is for your welfare, this is for your happiness. But his disciples don't want to listen to him, and they don't try to understand, and they actually turn away from his instruction. Okay, so now the text says, with that, the Tathagata is not satisfied. Of course, he's not satisfied, and he feels no satisfaction. He's not happy that his disciples are not listening to him, and that they're actually going astray. Yet he dwells unmoved, mindful, and fully aware, clearly comprehending. So his mindfulness in this situation is the first foundation of mindfulness that he cultivates. So here the Buddha maintains this equanimity when the disciples are not following his instructions. He doesn't fall into dominasa, into grief, displeasure, sadness, disappointment. And of course, he's not elated by this and joyful over it, but he maintains this equanimity. So that's the first foundation of mindfulness. The second foundation of mindfulness, again, the Buddha is giving his teaching, his instructions, giving them guidance on what's what for their welfare and happiness. Okay, some don't pay attention or don't listen to him and take his advice, while others listen and take his advice. Okay, so this is called a mixed audience. Okay, so with that, again, the Tathagata is not satisfied and feels no satisfaction. That is, he's not satisfied with those who don't pay attention and turn away from his instructions. And yet he's not dissatisfied and feels no dissatisfaction. So remaining free from both satisfaction and dissatisfaction, he dwells in equanimity, mindful and fully aware. Again, that mindfulness here is the second foundation of mindfulness that he cultivates. Okay, then the third situation, this is where the Buddha is teaching a group, and everyone in the group pays attention to his instruction and follows it, so they do not turn aside from the teacher's instruction. Okay, so with that, the Tathagata is satisfied. Now he's satisfied and he feels satisfaction. So he would feel some kind of, even I would say he might feel some somanasa, some joy or pleasure in that. And yet he dwells unmoved, mindful and fully aware. Again, that mindfulness is the third foundation of mindfulness that he cultivates. And so in this way it's said that he's fit to instruct the group. So it's with reference to this that it was said that there are these three foundations of mindfulness.
Pante, shouldn't the Tathagata neither satisfied nor dissatisfied is in this equanimity? Because in the first,
you have to press, there's a button, you turn it up.
It's red. I think the batteries might be dead batteries from the
Okay, just try it. There might be still a bit of life in it. Okay, so speak loudly.
Section 22,
yeah.
It says, with that, the Tathagata is not satisfied and feels no satisfaction,
yeah.
Right? So, and in section 23, it says he's neither dissatisfied nor satisfied. But would equanimity be neither satisfied nor dissatisfied? Because in section 24, it says he's satisfied and feels satisfaction. Shouldn't it be like the same reaction or same whatever?
I think... No, I don't think that the Buddha, though he said that he remains unmoved, I didn't check the Pali word on this, but I think what's meant by unmoved is that he's not moved by attachment to the situation. But when the disciples like listen and pay attention and follow his instruction, he'll feel happiness over that. You feel pleased with that. It's not like he's, you know, just a completely unfeeling block of stone. Yeah, Edward. You have to speak loudly now.
Yeah, the three foundations of mindfulness in other suttas will experience the liberation of attaining of the jhanas, and the attaining of the jhanas using of the sina, or actually attaining of the jhanas through a pure or beautiful sina, or the Brahma Vihara. But here is different. I don't know why he will change from the three foundations.
Wait, say again, I don't know.
In another sutra, there was a three foundations of mindfulness, with the liberation, attainment, and the attainment of the jhanas, which is actually also
which other sutta did you see three foundations?
I don't have my book at the moment. I have looked it up and actually came up with another explanation. And then he expressed it differently. I don't know why would they use the same.
I don't know a sutta that explains three foundations of mindfulness in terms of the way. I'd have to have the text cited.
Actually, if you go to the notes, I believe that when I went into the notes, it actually led me to that sutta. I looked it up and it was actually a different explanation.
Let me see. No, I don't. You said that it's in the notes?
Yeah, in the notes we have, actually, we go to another, you know, like, note before that, and it will be another sutta. We would explain liberation, attainment, and attainment of the jhana, or the four Brahma Vihara, which is the three foundations.
That's referring to the next section, not to the three foundations of mindfulness section. Let's go to the next section so that we finish the sutta.
Please. I don't get it. I'm so sorry. The three foundations of mindfulness are...
Okay, in this case, the Buddha... In a way, mindfulness here is in the background. But when the disciples are not listening, not following instructions, the Buddha doesn't feel satisfied. And yet he remains unmoved, mindful and clearly comprehending. When there's a mixed audience, some following, some deviating from his instructions, the Buddha is not satisfied and feels no satisfaction. I would think, I have to say, that he should be satisfied and feel satisfaction with those who are following the instruction. And yet he's not dissatisfied. I have to say, the second one I'm a little puzzled by myself. The third one is obvious. Okay, when the disciples follow the instructions, then the Buddha is satisfied and feels satisfaction.
Yeah, yeah, that is the case. The second one needs a little further thought, but let me just go quickly to end the sutta. Okay. Okay, so the three foundations of mindfulness, they qualify the Buddha as the teacher. So then it goes on to say, among the teachers of training, he is the one called the Anuttara Purisa Dhammasarathi, the unsurpassed leader or trainer of persons to be tamed. And with reference to what was this said? Okay, then he uses the simile of the elephant trainer who is able to train an elephant so that the elephant will go in any direction in which he's instructed to go, east, west, north, or south. Similarly with the horse, with the ox. So those are animals to be tamed. And the word used here is dhamma, to be tamed. Not Dhamma, but Dhamma. Okay, but in describing the Buddha, his role is that of a sarathi, which means like a trainer. Literally, it's a charioteer who trains Purisa Dhamma, persons who are capable of being trained or tamed. And how does he do that? He tames a person to go in eight directions. And these eight directions are what are called elsewhere the eight vimoka, which is often translated eight liberations. But these are not states of final liberation. But these are temporary liberation of mind. You know, states of exalted states of samadhi, except for the last one. Okay, the first three are a little problematic. I don't want to go into attempts to explain them here. But the first three seem to be different modes for attaining the four jhanas. One is called, okay, I'll explain them very briefly. Possessed of form, he sees forms. This is the first direction. So, in order to understand these, we do have to rely on the commentary, because the suttas themselves don't give an explanation of what is meant. So, possessed of form, the commentary says, is that one takes some visible form based on one's own body, and one uses that as an object of concentration. So one could take the black of the hair, since Indians have black hair, and use that as a kasina object representing the blue kasina. Or one can take the red color of the blood to represent the red kasina, the whites of the eyes to represent the white kasina. And so one uses some internal object in order to focus the mind on, in order to gain absorption. Okay, then the second one is not perceiving forms internally, he sees forms externally. I was just thinking that describes me perfectly right now, but I don't consider this a liberation. I'm not seeing forms internally, and I'm seeing forms externally. But this is the case of one who doesn't use some part of the body is the object of concentration, but uses an external form as the object of concentration. So somebody might focus on like the red soil to get the earth kasina, or the blue sky to get the blue kasina, or a white cloud to get the white kasina, or make a kasina object that's a circular disc that represents either one of the elements or a particular color. Okay, then he's resolved only upon the beautiful. This is what you're referring to, Edwin. This is using either extremely beautiful color casinas. I think that would be the correct interpretation. Extremely beautiful colored objects as the basis for meditative absorption. But the commentary says one could also consider this to refer to the Brahmaviharas, or the four divine abodes, loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, or equanimity. Okay, then come the four formless meditations. And then the last one is the special attainment called the cessation of perception and feeling, which is attained not merely through samadhi meditation, but as through the combination of samadhi and insight. Okay, so then the text concludes by saying that guided by the Tathagata, the person to be attained goes in these eight directions. And that takes us to the conclusion of the sutta. Okay, at this point I'll have to stop, and if there are questions, points for discussion, we'll meet here again at 12:15, then we can have some discussion. Okay, let us end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, so we share the merits with the deities, the devas, the buddhas, the fear spirits, the nagas, the dragon spirits, and all sentient beings. And before we do that, next week we have the class on sutta number 138. Should be able to do the whole thing in one session. Okay, so let us recite. Akasata chadumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chadumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumodipa Chiram rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu mamparam etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavatacham hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavatacham hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya avichihetato E tanta re satta kayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanyino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibutin. Please remember that I think it's 2 weeks from now there's going to be a third retreat on the Abhidhamma. So even if you haven't taken the first two retreats, if you want to come to this retreat, still possible. No prerequisites. And I think it'll be pretty intelligible on its own, even if you didn't do... Anyway, the first session, I'm going to review the key points from the previous two retreats.
If you enjoyed this sutta, please come.
And if you like the really dry, boring stuff. I guarantee it can't be drier or more boring. But more insightful and more conducive to higher wisdom than the Abhidhamma retreat. You can go across to the office and register for that retreat, and better register quickly because there's a limited number of seats. And it's going on a first-come, first-served basis. So if you're vacillating, uncertain, make up your mind and register. Oh, we finished? Okay, we finished. This is the end of three.
Thank you.